Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. This week, Disrespect is shifting its production schedule. We don't have an interview, but we do have 42 solid minutes of news for you. These are not the articles from the newspaper that we read, but these are abridgments or condensations of those same articles from the papers that are identified in the broadcast. Vancouver gay bashing ruled a hate crime. Construction worker gets 6 years for attack that caused brain injury. As the sheriff slapped handcuffs on convicted gay basher Sean Woodward and led him away to begin serving a 6-year sentence, members of Vancouver's gay community, who had packed the small courtroom, embraced each other, their faces wreathed in broad smiles of relief. The harsh punishment for Mr. Woodward's aggravated assault against a gay pub patron was meted out after Provincial Court Judge Jocelyn Palmer concluded the attack was a hate crime. "I see no possibility for Mr. Woodward's abhorrent behavior other than virulent homophobia," Judge Palmer concluded, noting that motivation was a key factor in determining his sentence. Outside the courthouse, activists expressed hope that the court's ruling would send a strong message to would-be assailants of gays to think twice about it in a city that has been called the gay-bashing capital of Canada. "We have to make sure such crimes are a thing of the past so we don't have to gather here again," said an emotional Janine Fuller, manager of Little Sisters Bookstore. "The ruling that this was a hate crime is hugely important." Jennifer Breakspear, executive director of Community, a queer resource center, referred to a number of serious violent attacks against gay men in the last few years. "It's been rough going," Ms. Breakspear said, "but I believe this sentence sends a strong message that hate and violence against our community will not be tolerated by the criminal justice system. Authorities are taking these crimes seriously, and our hope is that people may now be deterred from attacking us." That in the Globe and Mail, Tuesday, November 9th, Rod Mickelberg in Vancouver. Canada endorses Indigenous rights. Canada has finally endorsed the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Harper government announced the endorsement Friday after a meeting between Canada's ambassador to the United Nations, John McNay, and the president of the United Nations General Assembly. The endorsement comes 3 years after the declaration passed through the General Assembly without Canada's support, and less than 2 weeks after Broken People's Broken Policy, a Toronto Star investigation into Ottawa's chronic mishandling of its policies towards this country's native population. In a statement Friday, Indian and Northern Affairs Minister John Duncan said Canada has endorsed the declaration to further reconcile and strengthen our relationship with Aboriginal peoples in Canada. Sean Atleo, National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, welcomed Friday's endorsement as an opportunity to hit the reset button in our relationship. But he said the declaration alone would not change much in the everyday lives of this country's Aboriginal populace, many of whom live in third world conditions. Quote, "Now that it has finally arrived, we can get on with an agenda for change in our communities," unquote, Atleo said. That by Brent Popplewell, staff reporter for the Star. Raise for hospital workers puts squeeze on cash for frontline. The Ontario government's plan to largely erase its record deficit by reining in public sector wages is in tatters after an arbitrator's ruling awarded a pay hike to thousands of hospital workers. The ruling all but ensures that the McGuinty government will not be able to balance its books on the backs of public sector employees. Tom Clason, president of the Ontario Hospital Association, which represented hospitals in the latest arbitration case, said the only way the government can impose a two-year wage freeze on the province's 750,000 employees who bargain collectively is by introducing legislation. The plan failed, he said in an interview. What we need is a new plan. In the ruling, arbitrator Kevin Burkett awarded 2% annual raises over 2 years to 16,000 workers in 38 hospitals. Labor leaders say they fully expect the ruling to set a pattern for the hospital sector as other workers, including registered nurses, also seek arbitration when their contracts expire. If the ruling sets a precedent for the sector, Mr. Clason said, the province's 154 hospitals would have to find $280 million in savings this year alone to cover the cost of an across-the-board wage increase. Charlene Stewart, head of the Service Employees International Union, which represented workers in the arbitration, said many hospitals already have a shortage of frontline workers. They've been cut to the bone already, she said. PC leader Tim Hudak criticized the arbitration ruling. Arbitrators need to respect the taxpayer who pays the bills at the end of the day, but unfortunately we're not seeing that, he said. New Democratic Party leader Andrea Horvath said the restraint plan was poorly thought out and criticized the government for not looking for savings by reining in salaries of hospital executives. And that by Karen Hallett in The Star. Ontario ER doctors miffed at doing, quote, discount work for Quebec patients, unquote. Luc Chagnon and his team of emergency room doctors treat almost as many Quebec patients as Ontario residents in their Ottawa area hospital. The only problem is his colleagues across the river are getting paid more for the same urgent care. Quebec has long opted out of an agreement among provinces that guarantees Canadians receive medical coverage at no additional charge when they travel within the country. The government compensates out-of-province physicians based on Quebec rates, which are, on average, the lowest in Canada. Yet Dr. Chagnon, chief of staff at Hawkesbury and District General Hospital, and other emergency room physicians on the eastern boundary of Ontario have been for years denied a fee top-up or shift modifiers, amounting to as much as 30% above the base rate that Quebec doctors receive for treating patients on evenings, nights, and weekends. After much pressure from the province's medical association and years of advocacy by Hawkesbury doctors, the Quebec government late last month pledged to change its rule applying the modified fee to doctors outside the province. I don't think they had too much choice. They were feeling the pressure, Dr. Chagnon said. He remains hopeful that the fees will be applied retroactively. Globe and Mail, Carolyn Alfonso. ER visits have become a marathon of suffering. They needn't be. In Edmonton, Paul Parks, president of the Emergency Medicine Section of the Alberta Medical Association, warned of the potential catastrophic collapse of emergency care. Most of the measures required to ease overcrowding and reduce waiting times, however, lie outside the ER. This is well articulated in a new report by John Ross, Nova Scotia's provincial advisor on emergency care. Dr. Ross begins his report with a quote from the late management guru Peter Drucker, that a hospital emergency department's mission is to give assurance to the afflicted. The doctors and nurses give assurance. The only proper way to give assurance in times of crisis is promptly. Standards do exist, the Canadian Triage and Acuity Scale, for example, but there is no incentive for respecting the standards and no consequences for failing to meet them. Only about 10% of ER patients are admitted to hospital. Of the other 90%, far too many have ended up in the ER by default because they don't have access to primary care. Walk-in clinics are a joke. They will treat the most mundane matters but refer anything even moderately time-consuming to emergency rooms. Many ER docs like having patients with minor problems because it's more lucrative, especially when paid on a fee-for-service basis. So in some respects, they are protecting their turf by arguing we need more ER docs. But get ER docs working on salary. Then, as Dr. Ross recommends, establish fast-track areas in emergency departments for the treatment of minor injuries and illnesses. Dr. Ross recommends transforming many smaller, inefficient ERs into community health centers that provide chronic disease management and primary care. One fundamental problem here is lack of nursing home and long-term care beds, and in many cases, a lack of home care services. Many seniors land in emergency departments when what they really need is care provided in their home or nursing home, Dr. Ross writes in his report. Similarly, he notes that many people with severe mental health and addiction problems, known as frequent flyers in ERs, could be better cared for with mobile crisis teams and in psychiatric facilities. In short, we need to reserve emergency rooms for emergencies, but to do so, we need to bolster access to primary care and long-term care, solutions that are not simple, but urgent. This in the Globe and Mail, November 4th, by Andre Picard, Second Opinion. Cancer patient in legal limbo. Martin Kneva has been breaking the law each time he uses marijuana to ease the symptoms of his stomach cancer, even though he has a doctor's prescription for the weed. Kneva, former executive chef at Carmen's Banquet Center, is entitled to what's known as a medical marijuana license from Health Canada, but has been caught in a bureaucratic runaround and massive wait list since a Toronto internist prescribed the drug in June. An increasing number of Canadians are caught in Kneva's circumstance, although the exact number on the wait list is not known. MP Ujjal Dosanjh, federal Liberal health critic, says the problem appears to be widespread. Forcing people who require medical marijuana to remain without licenses because of delays effectively makes criminals out of patients, said Dosanjh, a former federal health minister. It's important to understand that if there is a legitimate need for medical marijuana, which is sanctioned by Canadian law, it is the government's obligation to make that process as smooth as possible. Many of these cases have a very tortured history. Health Canada does have a temporary delay in processing applications, said spokesperson Christelle Legault, due to a sharp rise in the number of applications received in recent months, although application numbers are not provided. Kneva said he intends to grow his own in a non-residential location approved by a landlord in small amounts that would save him money and aggravation. Right now, someone has to drive him to Toronto to buy weed at a cost of about $200 an ounce from a compassion club he does not want to identify because the transaction is also illegal. He said he uses about 2 ounces a week in small amounts, sometimes every hour, to give him the energy and pain relief to eat, shower, or occasionally take a walk. The only other drugs I take right now are an acid reducer for my stomach and antibiotics for an infection around the feeding tube in my stomach, Kneva said, noting that without the weed, he would be limited to anti-nausea drugs and prescription pain relievers. That by Joan Walters in the Hamilton Spectator, Tuesday, November 9th. Painkillers, birth disorders linked. Use of mild painkillers such as acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and aspirin in pregnancy may have helped increase male reproductive disorders over the past few decades, according to a new study. The study, published in the European journal Human Reproduction, involved written and telephone surveys of 1,463 women in Finland and 834 in Denmark. It was supported by laboratory research that found that analgesics acted in a similar way to phthalates, chemical compounds used in plastic that are known endocrine disruptors. The painkillers disrupted androgen production in the rats and interfered with supplies of testosterone during the period of gestation when male organs were forming. Researchers noted that a single 500 milligram acetaminophen tablet, equal to one extra-strength Tylenol in Canada, contains more endocrine disruptor potency than the 10 most common environmental disruptors that will affect a woman during her entire pregnancy. The findings need to be interpreted with caution because they show an association rather than a direct cause, said Baski Tilagnathan of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in Britain. It is entirely possible that mothers took these analgesics for an ailment, for example, a viral infection, in pregnancy, that may have been the real cause for the noted problems, Tilagnathan said in a statement. and that by Andrea Gordon, family issues reporter, in November 9th, Toronto Star. At the quarter mark in the show, let's take a break.
Well, I'm ready.
He's ready.
Come on, let's ride. Of guts, twin carburetors and Teflon struts. When he stepped it down, the blood began to boil. All you can smell is that thunder and oil. I'm ready.
He's ready.
Come on, let's ride. I'm so ready.
He's ready.
Come on, let's ride. The next car get gonna be electrified. No more rumbling sounds. I'm ready.
He's ready.
Come on, let's ride.
Ready, ready, ready.
I'm so ready.
He's ready.
Come on, let's ride.
Ready, 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 ready.
Next car I get, gonna be electrified.
That from the Kingmakers, Electrified. The Dynamite guitarist, by the way, was John Cormier. If you want that album, email me. Listen for it at the end of the show or scribble it down now, dialogue@radio.fm. Tell me what you liked about the news and what you didn't. Children are not eggs to be graded. Re-Tory leader gives vague new report cards an F, November 11th in the Star. This from the editorial letters. It should come as no surprise to anyone that students range in ability from very high to very low. It is the responsibility of the elementary school to nurture all of these children. More than 35 years ago, when I was supervising a student teacher, I visited her classroom placement, where the regular teacher was administering an oral arithmetic quiz to her class of special children. After the children had exchanged papers and marked them, the teacher had the children rise in order of scores, 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10, and so on. I would find it almost impossible to devise a more efficient way to destroy the self-images of children with limited abilities. But when we grade young students, this is exactly what we are doing. To tell half of them that they are below average is unnecessarily cruel and serves no real purpose. It's important to tell parents when their child is having difficulty. This is much more useful to both the child and parent than a C or a D on a report card. Not everyone is going to be a doctor or an engineer. We need to value our children, not treat them like eggs that need to be graded. William Phillips in Toronto. Teen inmates' calls for help were ignored, records reveal. During her year in federal custody, teen prisoner Ashley Smith was trying to turn her life around, seeking counseling and medical support to stop the downward slide that led to her death, while guards watched, correctional documents reveal. Smith's prison records, released to Kim Pate, executive director of the Canadian Association for Elizabeth Fry Societies, through a request made on the teen's behalf before she died, include thousands of documents and paint a far different picture of the young Maritimer than the one presented by the Correctional Service. There were at least 90 instances where she was trying to seek the assistance or support of staff, Pate told the Star. She was requesting access to programs, phone calls to her family, hospital visits. Pate said from a review of the record, Smith's requests for assistance were ignored. Pate says the documents show Smith's attempts at self-harm escalated when prison officials responded to her calls for help by isolating her in segregation cells and drugging her. 5 months before she died, Smith asked Pate to review her prison files to find out why she had been confined to a windowless room 23 hours a day for months on end, wearing nothing but a padded suicide gown and shackles. Last April, Federal Court Justice Michael Kellen said the Correctional Service of Canada broke the law by not releasing Smith's records while she was still alive. We didn't know the degree to which the law had been violated, said Pate. The records, Pate says, reveal more than 170 use of force incidents where Smith was involuntarily injected with drugs or pepper sprayed to manage her behavior. The count also includes at least 10 cases of involuntary body cavity searches. There are at least 60 cases where Smith's signature should have appeared on personal documents such as psychological assessments, but did not because she wasn't allowed to use a pen or her hands were handcuffed behind her back. Smith landed behind bars at age 15 for breaching probation after an incident in which she threw crabapples at a mailman in her hometown of Moncton, New Brunswick. As a young offender, she racked up additional institutional charges that expanded her stay in custody continually. Despite the family's objections, Smith was shunted into federal custody at age 18 and bounced through a series of institutions within the Maritimes, Quebec, the Prairies, and Ontario. An inquest into her death is scheduled to begin in January. Ontario's Deputy Chief Coroner, Dr. Bonita Porter, is expected to issue a ruling by Monday on the inquest scope. The family has argued that the jury should hear about the abhorrent conditions spanning Smith's entire time in custody. Porter had initially planned to consider only the few months leading up to the teen's death, spent primarily in Ontario. Pate hopes the recommendations stemming from the inquest will prevent this from happening to other women. We're a long way away from people with mental health issues getting appropriate care. That by Diana Zlomislik, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. And according to Saturday's Star, scope of Smith inquest expanded, probed to include all factors affecting suicidal teens' state of mind. The family of Ashley Smith is heartened by the decision, but will continue to press for a criminal probe and Royal Commission of Inquiry, lawyer Julian Faulkner told the Star. On Friday, Dr. Bonita Porter expanded the scope of the inquest into Smith's death to include all circumstances that may have affected the 19-year-old's state of mind when she tied a piece of cloth around her neck in 2007 and pulled tight while correctional officers at Kitchener's Grand Valley Institution stood by. Prison officials had ordered staff not to enter her cell if she appeared to be breathing. Smith had been labeled a difficult inmate whose self-harming behavior triggered too much paperwork. The inquest is scheduled to start in Toronto on January 10, 2011. Porter's decision quashes her original ruling that an inquest would examine only the last few months of Smith's life in Ontario. The family is heartened that Dr. Porter has recognized the merits of their concerns and abandoned the old scope, Faulkner told the Star. And that again is from Diana Zlomislik in the Toronto Star, staff reporter. Disabled girl spent 9 days with mom's body. Chilliwack, B.C. The British Columbia coroner is investigating after a mentally disabled 15-year-old girl was left alone with her mother's corpse for 9 days despite warnings from family members and neighbors that the girl was at risk. Neighbors finally broke into the family's mobile home September 15th and found the girl emaciated and filthy. We did what we could here, and we tried. Lawrence Jewett, manager of the mobile home park in Cultus Lake, B.C., said Friday. Jewett and another man broke into the home when no one answered the door and found the mother's decomposing body on the floor. The girl was sitting on the couch. He and his wife took the girl to their home and cared for her. Edith Jewett said the teen, who cannot be identified because she is now in provincial care, had lost a lot of weight. At first, I didn't recognize her. She was so much skinnier. The girl's adult brothers and several neighbors said they complained to the authorities that the mother was a drug addict and alcoholic who neglected and verbally abused the girl. BC Children's Minister Mary Pollack issued a statement defending her department's actions. Legislation prevents the ministry or the minister from commenting further on the specifics of this case, but we take this matter very seriously, Pollack said. This situation is tragic, but we must caution people from forming conclusions that are not based on all the information. Pollack said a regional complaints consultant has reviewed the file. As well as the region's senior practice analyst, and the consultant has written to family members. Mail. Good. Canadian Press from the Toronto Star, Saturday, November 13th. No byline. Seniors died hungry, families say. Two elderly residents died after suffering severe malnutrition and weight loss at a Toronto retirement home, their families and friends charge. A few months after an emaciated Danny Henderson, 74, died in hospital last winter, Toronto public health officials investigated a complaint and concluded there were no problems at In Touch Retirement Living near Weston Road and Lawrence Avenue. By the end of July, another resident, Edith Farrell, 80, also died in hospital, suffering from clinical starvation, according to her daughter, a registered nurse. No new public health investigation was carried out. Margaret Roberts said her 80-year-old mother, Edith Farrell, needed pureed foods and help eating, but got none of that from In Touch. Roberts is a registered nurse who works and teaches nursing in Virginia. Her mother chose to stay in Canada because she felt Toronto was her home. When she visited her mother last spring, Roberts said she was shocked at her sunken cheeks. Roberts said Farrell's ability to eat independently was declining as a result of her dementia. I'm not going to blame anybody for my mom's refusing to eat. I work with that. But there was a lack of intervention. Resident Nancy McEachern said she called an ambulance last spring, worried that Farrell was starving. Roberts said after she saw her mother last spring, she arranged for a dietitian to visit, but by that time, it was too late. Once the human body is not fed sufficiently for 4 to 6 weeks, it starts to shut down. You lose the desire to eat completely, she said. Roberts said test results showed that her mother was suffering from clinical starvation, dehydration, and seriously diminished kidney function. Roberts said she tried to get her mother in a nursing home but realized she would not survive the long wait for a bed. In Ontario, there are 24,000 people waiting for one of 77,000 nursing home beds. Her mother, Edith Farrell, died in hospital on July the 31st. Former residents say they never saw his family visit but loved Danny Henderson's rendition of Danny Boy and his gentle ways. Starting last year, Henderson struggled to eat and rarely touched his meals. Nobody helped him, his friends said. They'd put the plate down in front of him and he'd just sit there, said Eunice High, 66, who lived there for 4 months last year. The food was awful, but he wasn't able to eat it anyway. When the meal was done, they'd just take his plate away. Rosalie Cowan, a former nurse who regularly visits the home, said it was the saddest thing. Danny grew so thin, he couldn't sing anymore. High believes severe malnutrition led to Danny's death. It made me so angry. When is the government going to step in and help these people, High asked. Ontario Coroner's Office said it has no record of investigations into deaths at the home over the past 3 years. And that in the Toronto Star by Moira Welsh. Tories must boost aid to injured vets, Dallaire says. Warns morale will fail if government fails to act quickly on grievances. The conservative government will face shrinking morale in the military if it doesn't act fast on the grievances of injured soldiers, one of Canada's most recognized veterans warns. Liberal Senator Romeo Dallaire said the Harper government has a moral obligation to boost support for soldiers. What we have is a very honest and concerned perspective by injured veterans that can have a significant effect on those who are still serving, he said in an interview with The Star. Opposition MPs are echoing his call for action, saying the Star series has cast a stark light on the frustrations and worries that confront wounded soldiers as they struggle to rebuild lives and careers left shattered by grievous injuries. Wounded soldiers are being cheated. They are not receiving their due and feel the government is alienating those who stood for the infantry, said Liberal MP Dan McTeague, whose nephew Mike McTeague was seriously wounded in a 2006 suicide attack near Kandahar. The Canadian public is unanimous in its view that there should be adequate compensation and lifetime help for those who will need it, the MP said. Dallaire, who commanded a United Nations peacekeeping force that was overwhelmed during the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, is now the chair of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. From that perch, he sought to assure the ranks of worried, wounded soldiers that they've been heard. He is personally overseeing a review of the so-called New Veterans Charter, the 2006 document that outlines services, compensation, and benefits for the injured, and said various other committees and government advisory panels are examining the necessary fees. We're talking about guys that are already hurting, Dallaire said. We're just not getting the speed of response. Topping the list of changes is that Ottawa replaced the lump sum payment now awarded to injured soldiers with the monthly pension that had been in place for those injured before April 2006. Wounded soldiers have complained the switch to a lump sum leaves them shortchanged. The military would be satisfying its obligations under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms if it kept wounded soldiers in uniform, but it could also face legal challenges from other groups who want to see the military recruiting disabled people into its ranks. It's a complex situation that can only be resolved, I think, politically, because these are part of the legal processes under the National Defense Act and the Human Rights Charter, said Dallaire, accusing federal politicians of being scared to challenge the status quo. That story from the Toronto Star by Alan Woods, Bruce Campion Smith, and Richard J. Brennan in the Ottawa Bureau. Don't cheat our veterans. An editorial. Prodded by protests before Remembrance Day, Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government juiced up some benefits. But the problem is also systemic, says former Veterans Ombudsman Pat Stogren. Veterans get shoddy treatment from a terrible system with an insurance industry culture, he recently told a Commons panel. The worst injured will get $58,000 or more a year, Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn promises, and those in rehab will get $40,000 more. The National Council of Veterans Associations calls this $2 billion program over the life of current vets a good first step, but it isn't satisfied. There's still controversy surrounding the lump sum disability benefits of up to $276,000 that have replaced lifetime pensions. And a Commons report warns that the charter is a distinct step backwards in financial security for troops with serious injuries. There's particular concern about the adequacy of pensioners' benefits. Worst yet, many veterans have had to fight bureaucrats to get their entitlements, and the military is more eager to release disabled troops to civilian life than to give them non-combat jobs. Blackburn promises more fixes. Canada's MPs should give them close scrutiny and hear from the veterans themselves. The nation has to get this right. We owe our troops that much and more. After injury, there's a place for me here. When Brock Blazek looked at his right foot peeking out from the sheets, his first thought was amazement at the surgical precision he saw at the end of the bed. For 2 weeks, Private Blazek was rarely awake, and even when he was doped up on medication. When he finally regained consciousness, he saw his mother, Diana Blazek, beside his bed in the military hospital. "Look, Ma," he pointed out to her, "they even matched my toes and my tan lines." "That is your foot, you idiot," Blasek told Brock, your ugly big toes. You think the military would go and recreate your big feet and your tan line? So focused on his real foot, Blasek said his happiness at having his own foot still on his right leg overshadowed his discovery of his amputated left leg. At 21 years old, 1 month before he was scheduled to return home, on April 3, 2010, Blasek took one step in the wrong place, on a former Russian mine. The force of the explosion sent Blasek, who was carrying about 65 kilograms of equipment, 6 meters in the air. He had time to wonder in that split second when it detonated whether he had been hit by a rocket-propelled grenade or an IED. After you hit the ground is finally when you hear the explosion, Blasek recalls. It occurred to him that everyone who had stepped on an IED before him had died, and he remembered the words of a medic who told him that passing out increases a victim's chance of dying. I didn't pass out until 37 minutes later when the helicopter got me to Kandahar airfield. There was no hope for his left leg. In Germany, as Blasek was in a coma, the doctors decided to try to save his right leg. Just 6 months after the explosion, Blasek has returned to CFB Edmonton and, despite an hour of physio every day, works a full shift in the dispatch office at the base. He had been engaged to Mary in 2011, but when he returned back home and spent months in hospital and then at the Glen Rose Rehabilitation Center, those plans fizzled. Blasek's only certainty these days is his family will always be there to help him. His younger sister Hannah moved to Edmonton to live with him and is making plans to study physiotherapy. Sometimes he'll ask me to get him something, and I say, get it yourself, you got legs. And then I realize that's not true anymore, says Hannah Blasek. It can still make us laugh, and sometimes I get it for him, and sometimes I make him go get it himself. Blasek knows his active duties are over, but his military ones are not. This is all I've ever wanted to do, and yeah, I may never go back, but I will always remain in the military. There's a place for me here, says Blasek, whether I have both my legs or just this one. In that story from the Toronto Star, Wednesday, November 10th, Petty Fong, the Western Canada Bureau. Security ramp to the bazaar at Seoul Summit. Security has ramped up for the G20 summit in Seoul, South Korea, and so has the bazaar. From goldfish water testers, face-to-face recognition systems, to martial arts-trained police, the country made plenty of odd preparations for the event. A look at the top 10 oddities. Security goldfish. 6 goldfish are being used to check the purity of the water supply to restrooms at the Convention and Exhibition Center in southern Seoul. Martial arts police. Hundreds of police officers with martial arts training are being used during the summit. In October, about 300 of them staged a demonstration, punching wooden plates in two and breaking bricks with their heads. Piece of cake. A wedding cake-inspired art installation in Seoul made a fashion faux pas of global proportions when it mistakenly dressed a 3D caricature of the Prime Minister of Australia in a dirndl, which is the traditional dress of Austria. Fenced out. It apparently takes only a 2-meter-high fence to keep terrorists out of South Korea. Nearly 2 meters long and constructed around the main venues, there's no word if it's anything like Fortress Toronto's own fence. Robot weapons. Police have a variety of weapons, including robots. Other weapons include water cannons, tear gas, armored vehicles, roadblocks, and helicopters. Deja vu. 20,000 to 40,000 protesters have already staged rallies, according to Reuters. Besides massive crowds, South Korea has provided a flashback to the G20 in Toronto as a special law has been created to give police more power to thwart protests. Demonstrations are banned within a 2-kilometer radius of the main venue. And war. South Korea is still technically at war with North Korea, and that could concern the summit, according to Reuters. South Korea's defense industry is preparing for 8 scenarios where North Koreans could provoke an attack, including sea border Intrusions. That story by Jenny Dunning in the Toronto Star. I have a new album came in on the mail. Backdoor Slam is the name of the group. And the album's called I'll Get Mine. And if you doubt this is blues, look at the authors. Jagger Richards, called No Expectations.
Darling, to pass this way again. Once I was a rich man, now I am so poor. Never in my sweet shore life have I felt like this before.
Backdoor Slam from the album I'll Get Mine and No Expectations. Expenses started to mount before summits even began. A new spending report shows the Harper government started racking up expenses for the G8 and G20 summits well before the June meetings even began. A list of expenditures for preparatory meetings obtained by the Canadian press includes more than $200,000 for a May meeting at Chateau Lake Louise in Alberta, $45,000 for an April meeting at Chateau Whistler in Alberta, $13,000 in catering costs for an Ottawa dinner in March. The preparatory meetings were intended to reduce the amount of time and resources required at the summit. While incomplete, the list offers an idea of the level of spending leading up to the summits. Critics say the spending goes against the intention of the meetings. These meetings were supposed to be about austerity, Liberal MP Mark Holland said. I see a lot of extremely expensive hotels on that list. The government did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The latest figures are after a release of new departmental spending records for the summits, which include $100 apiece pens for the leaders and more than $86,000 worth of lapel pins and zipper pulls. Despite the largesse, government officials have said they expect to come in well under their $1.13 billion budget for the meetings in Toronto and Huntsville. That from the Canadian Press, no byline. Tales of horror from a police state. Ours. The hearings by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and the National Union of Public and General Employees were focused on the summit this past summer in Toronto, but it often felt like a history lesson on 1935 Germany. John Prune hobbled to the front of the room leaning on a metal ski pole. The 57-year-old Christmas tree farmer and Canada Revenue Agency worker had his left leg ripped off in a gruesome accident 17 years ago. He now walks with a metal prosthetic. He was sitting with his 24-year-old daughter in the designated free speech zone at Queen's Park during the protest on Saturday, June the 26th, when riot police jumped him, he told the room. They knocked off his glasses, handcuffed him, and told him to stand. He couldn't. One officer ripped off his prosthetic leg, he said. He tells me to put it back on. Of course, I can't put my leg back on with my hands behind my back. Then he says, hop. Prune spent 27 hours in the Eastern Avenue flashy film studio turned squalid detention center before police let him go without his walking sticks or glasses. His charges had been, quote, lost, he said. These weren't thugs being arrested, Prune told the room, his voice breaking, just people who wanted to get a message out. The thugs we all know now were the men and women dressed in black who ransacked Yonge Street on Saturday afternoon, unimpeded by the city's 5,400 armed-to-the-teeth police officers. There was no violence, but lots of vandalism. And that is why the once immobile police sprung into action, we were told, treating protesters like rapists, beating them, tying them up, denying them water in a cold cell. Except the police activity wasn't a reaction, if you believe Sean Salvati's story. Salvati was the 10th person to slip behind the skirted table Thursday afternoon. He looked like a guy's guy, jeans, long sleeve t-shirt, short brown hair. He's 32 and works as a paralegal. He went to a Blue Jays game with four buddies 3 nights before the G20 summit. On his way out, he passed two police officers. He wished them good luck on Saturday before hopping into a cab. The cab made it two blocks before he was pulled forcefully out by the same officers and asked about his suspicious comment. After an hour-long interrogation by a growing number of officers, he was arrested for being intoxicated in a public place. He'd drunk 3.5 beers over the course of the ball game. At the station, Salvati said he was violently strip-searched. They kicked me in the knees, kneed me in the torso, slapped me in the face, dragged me along the floor until my pants and underwear were removed and left naked in a holding cell for 4 hours. He was never permitted to speak to a lawyer. On his release, he asked the sergeant for the name of the officers who interviewed him. I was told nobody came to interview me. I imagined the entire interview, he said. Even if some of it was theatrical license, the nasty details piled up in the courtroom. Kicking, punching, threats of gang rape, all this from people paid well to protect us. Their job is to enforce the law. Instead, they themselves broke it. Twice I heard the sad statement, I wasn't even protesting. A businessman was so frightened by what he saw on the streets that weekend, he didn't want to be photographed at the hearing. He worried police were watching him. It reminded me of that slippery slope and a line from Auden's Refugee Blues. Once we had a country and we thought it fair. First it was the anarchists who deserved the draconian measures, then the protesters, then anyone wearing black, then anyone on Queen Street, then anyone in a cab who casually said something nice to a police officer. If you take your constitutional rights as seriously as I do, send a protest letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper demanding a public inquiry. His email address is pm@pm.gc.ca. That from Catherine Porter in Saturday, November 13th, Star. Fallout over the G20, destroying democracy in an attempt to save it. Message to Seoul from Toronto, it's not just protesters you have to worry about, it's also the police. The South Korean capital is halfway through its own G20 summit, the first since ours last summer, and already there's footage of streets seething with demonstrators. The fact is that G20 summits have no place in the city. Cities, of course, are inherently democratic. G20 summits are overtly anti-democratic, even fascistic. A city is its infrastructure. That infrastructure is what we inhabit and what enables us to inhabit the city. But because of security concerns, G20 organizers and their uniformed henchmen feel they must shut down that infrastructure and with it, the city. The tales of police callousness and brutality being heard at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association are a disturbing reminder of the lengths to which the state will go to ensure its safety, even at the cost of ours. It's like the old line from the Vietnam War about having to destroy a village in order to save it. Torontonians and by extension all Canadians had their right to security suspended so as not to compromise the participants in security, or more to the point perhaps not to inconvenience these terribly important people. The fact of the matter is that most of these so-called world leaders could walk down the street naked and no one would bat an eyelash, Prime Minister Stephen Harper included. But the memories that linger are those of the insults and injuries inflicted by Toronto police on innocent people. It might not have been expected, but certainly it was intended. That by Christopher Hume, the architecture critic in the Toronto Star, Friday, November 12th. And our good news story for the week, more or less, ads calculated to cause offense. Leslieville Burger Bar touts fare for gluttons and stoners. Dangerous Dan's, a gritty Leslieville joint popular among big eaters and night crawlers, has launched an ad campaign calculated to cause offense, positioning itself as a purveyor of aggressively gluttonous fare that's perfect for adult recreational drug users. The campaign includes three radio spots featuring a group of stoned people semi-incoherently ordering takeout food and chatting about the musical Grease and tattooed genitals. Three other radio ads boast that some of the restaurant's more outrageously proportioned menu items have the potential to cause serious illness. One of those, the Coronary Burger Special, begins with a clinical description of a heart attack. First, a blockage occurs in the arteries. Oxygen depletes, and so on. Before concluding with a narrator jauntily proclaiming, beef, bacon, cheddar, a fried egg, deadly. The radio ads are airing only once each on Ryerson CKLN, concluding Thursday. They're also posted on YouTube. And that was last Thursday, Remembrance Day. The campaign also includes six posters with pictures of the diner's massive sandwiches and provocative lines like, "While we still have health care and meat is murder. Tasty, tasty murder." The campaign originated with a pair of employees at a local audio production house, eager to do work that reached beyond the conservative sensitivities of most advertising clients in hopes of submitting it to industry awards competition. They figured they had a willing partner in James McKinnon, the owner of Dangerous Dan's, who is known for instructing customers to place their orders with him because the waitress is dead. He likes being non-politically correct. He understands to be provocative is worth its weight in gold, said Drew Froman, a writer with Tattoo Sound and Music, who said he was one of five people who recorded the stoner commercials while genuinely baked. That one comes from the Globe and Mail, Thursday, November 11th, Remembrance Day. And that's all the news we have for Disrespect this week. But come back next week. We'll have an interview, and you know we will have more. To take us out, definitely traveling music from Backdoor Slam. This one by fiddler Jenny Bice, entitled Joe Cormier, La Bastrang. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.